where the big communal air raid shelter was. And as we were running down towards the Howard Park, a blooming barrage balloon caught fire. And my mother said, "Can we come in your clothes, mister?" My mother was in a panic. She had everything in this little tiny case, bottle of whiskey, and all the insurance policies.
That's
fine. Yes, yes. Yeah, so it was fun. What, I was born in Kilmarnock, which is in Ayrshire. It was the town where the first edition of Robert Burns' poetry was published. I think it was about 42,000 or more, 45,000. So, I mean, it was quite a reasonable-sized town. And it went to school at Bentinck School. That's primary school, state school. Very few private schools, not that my parents could have afforded it anyway. And then did very well in primary school and went to the academy, which was the high school where you could go through to your leaving certificate. We lived in the middle of the town, right on Titchfield Street, which went right through the middle of the town. And downstairs from us was all these grocery, fishmonger, and the big coal carts with the big Clydesdale horses. And we could look out our back windows and see them washing all the fetlocks, you know, and of course when the war came to an end and they were all dressing all the horses up, red, white and blue ribbons, it was really very nice. But the town was an industrial town. It had been an industrial town for a long time. It was even at the time of William Wallace in the late 13th century, about 1270 or 75 or something. It was enough of a town to have a group of apprentices go with William Wallace to fight the English. So, you know, it was an industrial town. It had Glenfield and Kennedy's hydraulic engineering that my brother worked in. It had Blackwood and Morton's carpets that my mother worked in, and Saxo and shoes, and Johnny Walker's whiskey distillery. The girl who lived in the flat above us, she worked in the distillery, and she had a blue and white striped smock. And when she went past you could really smell the whiskey. So we lived in, I suppose it's a tenement. Four families lived in the building, and downstairs was a shop. When I was born, it was a fish and chip shop. It was down there. But later on, it was an insurance company took that. And we had no bathroom in the house. You had a toilet on the bend of the stairs. And when the war started, we had to put we had a big plywood blackout thing that was kept in the toilet. And my brother, because the lady who lived across from us was an elderly widow, so, and my father was at sea, so my brother was the only man, he was 12, and he would put the blackout screen up for us. The town was, what would you say? We walked to school, walked to Sunday school, walked up to the guides. The high school was up on a hill and it had a tower on it, and we had a very good library, the Dick Institute. I gather this year it had a special display of Burns because, as I said to you, Kilmarnock was where the first edition of the poetry. So it wasn't all industry. I was a brownie and a guide and a ranger, and I was in the school choir and things like that. Not that I can sing, but I can make a loud noise. And through the school, we were introduced to Scottish country dancing. I think at that time, Jean Millington, you know, who was the mover and shaker in Scottish country dancing, I think she was probably in charge at Jordan Hill, where all the physical education teachers were being trained. So we all had Flowers of Edinburgh and Petronella in first year at high school. But of course, as we're getting to teens, we did Eight Some Reels and Dashing White Sergeants, and not a la Royal Scottish Country Dance Society. The unbridled stuff that Miss Millington was trying to tidy up. Where you go flying around, you know, and strip the willow and all these sort of dances. But our ranger captain, when I was in Rangers, she was the Scottish country dance representative for the north part of Ayrshire. And instead of running round the hall and doing exercises, we danced. So when the end of the Second World War came on and we had all these dancing in the park, my brother was in the Rovers and I was in the Rangers, and we did country dancing as a demo in the park to celebrate the end of the war. And my brother and I were the first couple always, and we said we were the best dancers, but I think it's because we were the shortest. We were sort of arranged by height. And the other thing that we did was they had festivals and you competed in them. And I remember, what would I have been, 16, I think, the festival that we were competing in. We did the Duke and Duchess of Edinburgh, so they'd just been married. I think that was about 1948 or 47, I'm not sure. And we also did the Reel of the 51st Division and the Glasgow Highlanders for the Strathspey. So that was competitive dancing. So, you know, I thought I was quite good at it. And I had my 18th birthday on the boat coming to Australia, but I didn't really get into country dancing in Adelaide. I didn't see an opportunity. I was in the combined church clubs doing marching exercises, dancing, rods and clubs. And I played hockey for Heathball, and I was getting enough physical exercise, I think. After I was married, it must have been, I went to one class that was being held in the old Caledonian Hall in King William Street. Oh no, what was her name? The lady that was had the bad arthritis. May Sinclair. She was teaching that class. And I went to this class, and they were getting up to do a dance. And someone said to me, "Do you know this dance?" I said, "Oh, I'm not sure." "Well, you better sit down." And I thought, well, blow you. And I wouldn't go back. I thought that was very un-Scottish. And then when Jean Lumsden was doing her WEA classes in Scottish country dancing, I went to those, and then I came to her class, and that would probably be what? Must have been at least maybe 25 years ago, something like that. And after I'd been dancing with Jean for a while, she suggested to me that I might like to teach, I might like to have a class. And I remember the day I was doing my written exam, it was the day my husband died in the morning, and I thought, well, this was the preliminary exam, and I was really in a sort of a haze, I don't know. So I did the exam, I did the practical exam. Some people felt that I was being very insensitive or not respectful to my husband. He's the first one that would have said, you know, "Well, get on with it. If that's what you're doing, do it." I have no idea how I passed my preliminary teacher's exam, but that would have been the 28th of June, 1991. So then I was running my own class from 1992 and had quite a lot here in the Burnside groups. This Rose Park Scout Hall. So I was here. And I had quite a big class, maybe 18 people. That was quite a big class. And it gradually dwindled away, and then it came on again, and then it went down again. And in, I think it was 1996, we were going to have the opportunity to do your full teacher certificate, and that was to be at Armidale in the winter school in the university at Armidale. And I have never been so anxious. I mean, I had set lots of exams in physiotherapy. We have a lot of practical exams, which are quite stressful. But that practical exam at Armidale was really the most stressful exam because people, Noriel and Jean, came every Sunday and gave me homework and things like this. And a group of people turned up every Sunday for about 6 months for me to practice my teaching. So by the time I came to sit the exam, I felt like I had the weight of all these people giving up all their Sundays, coming to here for me to practice my teaching skills on them. And I didn't realize, nobody had actually alerted me to the fact that if I was asked to recap the dance in the exam, then the teachers, the examiners, would be looking at my dancing. That was the way they did it. And they sort of pushed me to be the first recapper. So it's a bit like, phew, I've got through that. And I wasn't thinking about lift and flight and turning my toes out and all the other things. So the examiner said to me, you had very little lift. You had no real, in fact, we didn't like your dancing very much at all. And I thought, oh, blow. Jean told me that she and Noriel sort of went to bat for me and helped to get me through my class. Well, they did say my teaching skills were excellent and my theory was excellent, so that was all right. But my dancing was terrible. They should see me now. I've got no cartilage in this knee, so it's pretty hard to get any lift in anything. So that was, I think, 1996. That was the... And that was the teacher's certificate.
So you didn't actually go to Scotland to do work?
No. No.
Why did Jean have to go to St Andrews and you didn't? What was the situation?
Oh, I think she liked to go to St Andrews. I mean, that's her stamping ground. It's pretty close to where she came from in Scotland. I've only been back to Scotland once, and it was to... I went to an international physiotherapy conference in Stockholm in 1982, and then we went across to Scotland, but I didn't do any dancing in Scotland at that time. I had my daughter with me. My father worked for what's called a creamery in Scotland. He was initially at sea. When he was 16, he was at sea. He'd been apprenticed to the baking trade, and he was on the Cunard boats, and he was at sea, and then my mother worked in Blackwood Morton's carpet factory, and they made carpets for all the parliamentary houses, you know, in Australia, the first Australian. They had BMK carpets there, and that's where my mother worked. And they met at a dance. I'm sure they met at a dance. They loved dancing. And then they married, and my father went back to sea. But then he came back ashore, and that was probably, well, my brother was born in 1928. I think they were married in 26, and my brother was born in 1928, and they were just coming into the Depression, and it became difficult to get jobs for men. And he would teach people, usually widows, my mother said, you know, charming the women. he'd teach them how to bake. And, you know, there was little shops where people sold scones and things. And he could sell them the eggs and the margarine and the butter, because that's what the creamery did. It was Roalan Creamery, you know, like the man with the scouting, Roalan, Lord Roalan that started Scouts. Yes, so then they were married, and we lived in Titchfield Street. All my life I was living in Titchfield Street until we left Scotland. And my father's family, his father was Italian, and of course he was an ice de crema man. You know, I had a little cart, made ice cream, went around selling the ice cream. So then they had a cafe. It was L&P, Louis and Peter. But the Louis wasn't my father, it was my grandfather, and Peter was my father's stepbrother. So, but my father worked in the cafe at nights, you know, and until the war, you know, the sort of false war, 1939. So I was born in 31, in the right at the height of the Depression. How depressing. And he went back to sea straight away because of the... he didn't want to get enrolled, he didn't want to be conscripted. So he went back to the merchant service, which was what he had been in, and then they moved him into the Navy because they could get plenty of able seamen, but they weren't getting too many skilled artisans, you know. So he was in the Norwegian that really was almost like Dunkirk, but I think they did get the soldiers out of Norway. But my father's ship was sunk, but it didn't really go down because they were in the fjord. So he was ashore baking in a school, and he had a big French knife stuck in the end of his board. And they came back via Iceland to Glasgow with all the soldiers, and you could hardly move on the boat. I can remember my father describing it. And my mother, of course, because I was what? I was 8 and my brother was nearly 11. So my mother had to go to do essential work. She was in Saxon Shoe Factory, which was just across the road from us in Kilmarnock. And then she was in a wool factory where they were weaving, or they were making wool for the army uniforms and things like that. They were both very bright people, my mother and father. My mother didn't get to school till she was 7, and she was back out of school when she was 13 and a half. She was the only person in the family working. It was the end of the First World War, and my grandfather couldn't get work, so my mother was working in a brick factory. But although, and she was very determined that my brother and I were going to stay at school. We were going to get whatever opportunity. So we were sent to elocution lessons, which was to help my brother to spell. And I think he was dyslexic, the poor lamb, and he couldn't learn to spell. And if you couldn't spell, you couldn't pass exams.
What was this about elocution lessons? Why weren't you speaking English then?
Oh, yes, we were speaking English, but the idea was if you spoke properly, you would spell better. So that's the way it was sold to my mother. So my brother and I went to elocution lessons, 6 pence a week. We went to dancing lessons until my brother was old enough to rebel, and he wouldn't do it. But I was still, you know, oh, I do like to be beside the seaside in a little white dress with the red and white blue and tap shoes. And yes, and then we both went to piano lessons. So, you know, my mother was, although they were very working class, my parents, she was very determined that we would have opportunities because she felt that she never got a chance. So they were, she was wonderful parents. We always used to go for holidays to Northern Ireland, my mother and father. We used to go up in the bus to Glasgow and the boat from Glasgow to Belfast and the train, and I would be sick on the bus to Glasgow and I'd be sick on the boat to Belfast. I know how they put up with me. And of course, once the war started, well, then you couldn't go to Ireland. But we, you, my mother used to take a house in Arran, and for the whole school holidays, you know, the 2 months, and all the little cousins would come over, you know, and my mother would look. So that's the kind of person she was. She was a very capable and get everything done. And my father would, when he came home on leave, and we'd go down to the shore, and he was always for looking in the all the pools and finding the shells and the sea anemones. And yes, we had very good family relation. And we lived right in the middle of Kilmarnock, and New Year's Eve parties were always in our house. There'd be all these people coming in that would roll back the carpets, and my Uncle Archie would play the piano, or they had a mandolin, and we used to sing and dance and the usual Scottish New Year's Eve parties, Halloween parties. And I liked parties. And when I was about, I think I was six, my mother was up the street and this lady said, well, be all right if I send Tommy, I think, round about 1 o'clock tomorrow. My mother said, round where? And the lady says, for Margot's birthday party. I'd invited my whole class to come to a party that my mother didn't know anything about. But instead of sort of throwing up her hands, she rushed around and got the Bar's Iron Brew and the birthday cake and the bridge rolls and the gammon and put it all together because it was May and you could we could be outside on the grass, on the green. Yes. Oh, she was great. And everything, because we were doing elocution, we always had elocution concerts. And because I was in the church choir and the school choir, we always had concerts. And my mother rolled up to everything. Yes, great memories. And when we came to Australia, I remember I was already courting with my husband, who was Central European. And we went to a party and we were teaching these people to do an eights and reel. So my father and mother and my brother and I, and we all took an Australian to dance with. And we were teaching them how to do an eights and reel. And someone said to my husband, I expect you did this when you were a boy. And he said, oh, aye. Yes. But, you know, they were the life and soul of the party sort of people.
What do you mean by Central European? What does that mean?
Well, he was born in Lvov. And when he was born in Lvov, it was Polish. But it's now Ukrainian. And I think it's sort of where the Germans came through too. But his father's mother was Austrian. He spent a lot of time with her in... and she taught languages at the consulate. So it would be English Day, French Day, Polish Day. And of course he knew all the Polish, Serbian, Croatian, Russian... And the Cyrillic alphabet, he could read and write in the Cyrillic alphabet when he came to Australia. Could speak 10 languages, but, you know, about 5 or 6 of them were all interrelated. But didn't keep it up, and, you know, language, you've got to keep it up. Yes.
You said your mum and dad probably met at a dance.
Yes.
In those days, would that be called a cavi?
No, that would be the jiggin. Meet at the jiggin. Ceilidhs were in the north of Scotland. Jigging was dancing. And, you know, it was the sort of the days of the Black Bottom and the Big Apple and, the, you know, all those quick steps and foxtrots and chalk the ladies' heels. They'd have a competition. They'd put chalk on the ladies' heels and they'd waltz and they'd have to still have the chalk on their heels when they finished because they hadn't put their heels down. Yes, yeah. When I had my 16th birthday, I liked waltz cotillion. I don't know if it's in the book or not, but waltz cotillion, we danced it twice because it was my birthday. Now I'm going to have my... And we did Dash and Work Sergeant, ate some real drops of brandy, we called it, in our part of Scotland. And Pride of Erin and Highland Shutish. And when we came to Australia and we were down in Stenhouse Bay, we were teaching them how to do Highland Shutish down there. And they were teaching us, what's the Australian thing? Da-da-dee-da-dum, da-da-dee-da-dum, da-da-dee-dee-dee-dee. I don't know what they call it, but it's vaguely like Highland Shutish. Yes. So, because my parents were very social or, you know, gregarious almost, we had dancing in the house, you know, roll the carpets back and because my mother didn't mind, shove the furniture all around. And, of course, once we had the piano for us to have piano lessons, then two of my, they weren't really relatives, but I called them my uncles. Two of them could play the piano. In fact, quite a lot of people could play the piano well enough to dance to. No television, you've only got the radio, so...
That was before Jean Milligan, I think.
Well, no, she and Mrs. Stuart of Fasnacloich, they started about 1927, 28. Now, I wasn't born till 1931, so I was at high school when I was 11. So the Royal Scottish Country Dance Society had been going quite a while. And as I say, you know, our ranger captain, she was a Scottish Country Dance representative. So we were doing it properly with her. So we'd get the right steps and the right formations and put your hands in the right place and things. Yes. I probably always was interested in dancing. I liked Scottish country dancing. Because my husband wasn't Scottish, and really, verbally, he would say he didn't approve of all these Scottish societies and German clubs and things. We were all in Australia, we should be Australians. So I really wouldn't push the envelope too hard. Yes, once the Jean's classes at the WEA, once I went back to that, then I was going to the dancing. He didn't mind me going out. Once I was independently mobile, drove the car and could go out at night, and he didn't have to take me. So that was... It's all part of it, I suppose. My daughter had grown up, you know, and it's easier to... And I was very interested in positive ageing. And if you look at country dancing, Scottish country dancing, it has physical, intellectual, social, and if you don't equate spirituality or spiritual with religiosity, it's got nothing to do with religion, it's sort of spirit, you know, lift your spirit. The music does that. It's got a real positive element in it. And, of course, it's very friendly to the environment. So once I went to the School of Physiotherapy to teach, I was there for aged care. That was part of my brief, was to raise the students' awareness of positive ageing. And I did coordinate the graduate diploma in gerontology while the University of South Australia was running it. So that was reinforcing, you know, positive ageing. And if you look around, I've got three people in my class in their 80s. I think it's sad that we don't get more of the young ones. I think, you know, we keep coming up with ideas about how to interest the young ones, but we don't seem to get very far with it. I feel that there is at least five of the major private schools in Adelaide, in and around Adelaide, that had their beginnings with Scottish educationists. And somehow or other, we ought to be able to capitalise on that. I mean, Jean and I were asked to help with primary school children for the Highland Hoot that was held up at the up near Blackwood. What's that? I was involved with the what school? Jean had Coromandel Valley, and I had the one on the top of the hill. No. It was primary school.
Primary school.
No, it was on that road that goes that. The name of the school was the name of the road. I don't know. Anyhow, that was very interesting because those children were really quite interested in dancing. And if we could get that sort of set up, I'm sure eventually you'd get some carry through. You'd get somebody who learnt to do the steps when they were young, like we did, and learnt some formations and would like to come back to it, you know, later. So, but that was built into the curriculum. The children came with their teacher for a half an hour, and you had... grade 4, 5, was it summer 3, 4, and 5? Flagstaff Hill I had. And they were really, it was really nice teaching the children. I wore a different kilt. We were there, I think we had them about 5 lots, and then they did something at the Highland Hoot. And that I enjoyed it. I loved teaching. That's what I wanted, to be a biology teacher. But when I came to Australia, they didn't teach biology in Adelaide in 1949. Nope. And I didn't think my physics and chemistry were going to... So I was sort of directed into physiotherapy. And then in 1977, I went to the University of South Australia. It wasn't the University of South Australia then. It was the Institute of Technology. To the School of Physiotherapy, and was eventually a senior lecturer there. And so I had the best of both worlds. I during the war, you know, when we were all issued with tin cans with our gas masks in them, I had bandages and cotton wool and all sorts of stuff in my gas mask tin. And was always bandaging bits up on my brother, whether he had a sore or not. He was very patient with me. So, you know, that sort of need to be of service. So I still think now that I'm the age I am, if you can't be useful, you may as well be dead. So I'm in all sorts of things, you know, like the radio and the dancing, and I'm interviewing for medical students, and I'm in a couple of research projects in Alzheimer's and in flu injections. So stay busy.
How did you get into that Scottish radio? What happened there? How did you know about it?
Jean, she's always recruiting me into things. So she asked me to come and be interviewed, because they were interviewing, you know, just like you're doing here, about how did you come to Australia and what were you doing and so forth and so on. And then she said, well, you know, are you interested to do the course? Would you come on the committee? Are you interested to do the operator's course? So, you know, you've got to turn the grey cells over. I've always been like that, though, you know. I did physiotherapy in 55. I did chiropody in 64. I did the theory and practice of education early in the 70s. I did the graduate diploma in health counselling. I studied acupuncture. I'll just keep doing that. And then the country dancing. And as I say, you know, that was the worst exam of all. But I always have to be in something that has some sort of assessment in it. So I was quite interested to do the operator's course.
And last of all, what future do you see in country dancing here in South Australia?
Well, as I say, if we can't get some of the young people into it, the girls who do the Highland dancing, there doesn't seem to be a carryover. The boys that go to the piping, there's plenty of young people in Scottish things, but they're just not coming to the country dancing. So we take as many opportunities to put it on view and encourage people. I have to say that at the moment there seems to be another little wave, a little bit of interest in it, because I have about 5 people, youngish, you know, under 50, who sort of come and go. They're not coming all the time because they've got a lot of other commitments. But yes, if everybody would turn up, I would have 2 full sets and 2 over. But they don't always all turn up. You know, some are grandparents, and once the school holidays are on, they're minding the children, and husband and wife who... Now, she did Highland dancing, and she teaches her girls country dancing. But she has a new class every year, so it doesn't follow through very much. But their daughter has come over from England for 2 weeks, so they're away up to the centre of Australia with her. Well, you can't win. You just keep plodding on.
And Highland dancing that interested you when you were young?
It was, well, that was one thing. My mother didn't take me to do Highland dancing when I was young. I'm not sure why not. Maybe we did go to dancing, tap dancing, sort of posing dancing. Not ballet, but sort of stage dancing, yeah. Highland dancing was probably regarded as a bit expensive. It wasn't just a shilling a week to go to it. So, you know, it was probably... Or it may just have been that my mother didn't know anybody that taught Highland dancing, so she wasn't able to recruit us into that. Because I'm sure if she'd known someone, we would have been dragooned into it.
During the 40s and perhaps 50s, was it even then that the Highland dancer became just purely a demonstration sport?
It's competition. Now, as I said, in 1948, we were in a festival in Kilmarnock. I was reciting, so with my elocution, because I was still doing elocution up until I left Scotland. 12 years I was doing it. You would never guess, would you? Someone said, were they teaching you to speak with a Scottish accent? I said, no, Miss Craig. I always remember Miss Craig. She looked like Margaret Lockwood, and she was tall, and she wore tweed cape and a skirt, you know, down below her knee, and I thought, she's so pretty. I've lost my thread. You were asking me... Yes. Yes, so there's no... I think we would get somewhere if we had competitions, if we had schools competing against each other for the best country dancing. But I think because so many of the people that are teachers had a background in Highland dancing that was so competitive that they really don't want to bring that kind of competitive element into country dancing. They want it to be something that people do for pleasure. If you want to get the young ones interested, they are competitive. You need to make something that they would compete in. But if you raise that, you're immediately, no, we don't want that. We really don't want that. But we had it in, it would have been 48, I think. Whenever the Queen married, the Duke and Duchess of Edinburgh, was a new dance. And we did that, as I said. And we did the Reel of the 51st Division, which had come back from the war. And we did the Glasgow Highlanders. And that was competition. We were competing against three or four other ranger guide companies. You know, it was all young people. So I don't know. I don't know what you could do to stimulate interest in the dancing. It is very good for people, I think. As I said, the reasons I said, it's a positive exercise in positive aging. If you're not going to do crossword puzzles... That's what they say. Your brain needs to be exercised too. Yes. Well, he's a very nice man, and I think he's got a background in mathematics, but he does struggle with the dances. He always wants to dance it through to the music, you know, put the music on, let him dance it through. But once he has to repeat it, you know the way you have to do it twice, it gets difficult for him. But he is slowly improving, but that's nearly 2 years. You can look at somebody and say, It's hard work. It's like when I taught massage for 25 years, first and second year physiotherapy students. And you could say a third of the class, it would be easy. A third of the class could learn it with not too much strife. A third of the class would really struggle. I mean, we had hacking. And I looked at this girl and she was like this. She just couldn't seem, people learn. You can learn by hearing, you can learn by seeing, you can learn by doing. And if you happen to be somebody who learns by doing, and you're trying to teach somebody who learns by seeing, it's not always easy. But, I mean, you have to always remember, people are there for fun. Life is quite difficult enough without stressing yourself out with dancing. The only problem, I think, with country dancing particularly is that people will feel that they're letting down the other people, that they're getting in the way of the other dancers. And if the other dancers sort of suck their teeth at them, or when you go to a social, obviously they all run out, all the good dancers go together, so that they don't have to be put off by somebody who might be struggling. I think that's very sad. That's not what Scottish country dancing should be about. We should be quite keen to help each other. Yes.